tour I've ever been on, and certainly the most debauched. Chad and I watched porn in our shared hotel room at night, which aired for free and was the only thing we could understand without the aid of subtitles. We lay in our underwear in adjoining twin beds, half turned on, half wanting to make out, but instead talking about how we missed our girlfriends back home. Along with Helium, we would go to late-night dance clubs after playing shows during which we'd slammed a round of whiskey shots delivered to us on stage before the encore. In Hamburg, we went to a peep show where a dancer made this offer to Janet. "I'll lick your pussy, $20. Janet declined. We smoked cigarettes and weed when available, ate copious amounts of chocolate and cheese, and fell asleep mostly tipsy, if not outright drunk. On one long drive, in a fit of giddiness and in the spirit of sisterhood and spreading cheer, Corin and I convinced Janet to throw a mixtape out the van window. It was a cassette she'd been listening to nonstop, made for her by a friend, a boy she was trying to no longer have a crush on. That boy was Elliot Smith. I still think about that tape, flung, and how I urged it to be so. Gone. Since I had never before traveled to Europe, I tried to make the most of the trip, treating it like both a vacation and a reconnaissance mission. Despite not going to sleep until 3 or 4 a.m., when the tourist destinations opened in the morning, I would cram in an hour or two of sightseeing before we had to leave for the next city. I climbed up and down the roughly 500 steps of the Cologne Cathedral and the 400 steps of Gaudi's Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. Only upon completion of the ascent did I realize there was the option of an elevator. Both endeavors caused cramping and limited mobility the next day. I went to the Anne Frank House, the Louvre, Sacré-Cœur, the Kunsthal, and museums ranging from the British to the Van Gogh to a marionette museum in Switzerland. I bought art books and keychains, wine and postcards. I purchased prints of buildings and animals, rolling them up and stuffing them into shipping tubes that I had to keep track of for the rest of my travels. Only one, a 19th century illustration of a giraffe from the Musée National d'Histoire Naturelle in Paris, made it home. It hangs in my bedroom to this day, the only keepsake for my valiant effort to binge on culture, to see and experience Europe in a nearly sleepless, watercolor-like daze, wondering if I'd ever get a chance to again. People often ask me about groupies on tour, about whether I had random and meaningless and super hot sex. The answer is no, to all of it. We never had groupies. Writing that sad little sentence, "I wish we had," just so instead I could have written, "Yes, of course we had groupies. Endless, countless numbers of groupies. A cornucopia of groupies. Groupies coming out of my ears. Groupies for days." Sure, we had fans who displayed emotions similar to a crush, or were effusive enough to want hugs or to bring us gifts, who might even be bold enough to ask us on a date, or perhaps scream, "I love you," from the relative anonymity of a dark theater. But no one who waited outside the venue after the show or who we ran into later in the night at a nearby bar was someone any of us might end up going to bed with. Call it lack of opportunity or lack of imagination, but to be honest, it was mostly lack of interest. Corin was with Lance from the Dig Me Out tour on, and Janet and I were in relationships on and off for most of our touring and band life. But I'll admit, for the sake of seeming even a little less pitiful, there were two times I made out with people on the road. The first was in that summer of 1998, when Slater Kinney was finishing up the touring cycle for Dig Me Out in Europe. We were in Glasgow, which we'd flown into for a stretch of UK dates. We had a lot of friends who played music in that city, so we met up with members of Belle & Sebastian, Mogwai, The Yummyfur, and Biss at a local bar. We danced and drank and sat around a big table laughing and talking until late. We were beyond drunk, all of us. Someone had handed out shots of Aftershock, a cinnamon-flavored and candy-red alcohol. I watched my friends getting handsy and loose with one another, leaning in, staying too long, staring too hard. When the bar closed, we all stood out on the street awaiting taxis. And it was there, in front of everyone, that I made out with a guy from one of the bands. He had a shaved head and looked like a footballer. I climbed into the taxi alone. Back in my hotel, the room dipped and wobbled. I threw up repeatedly in the middle of the night. I was so hungover the next day that I couldn't get out of bed until we left for our show in Edinburgh at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I've seen pictures from that debauched event. My face is puffy, shiny, and bright red atop my body like an emergency vehicle light. My eyes are glazed. If getting drunk to the point of vomiting is what it takes to be brave enough to put my mouth against an acquaintance and colleague in front of all our mutual friends, I'm going to say it might not be worth it. The next time I had a dalliance on tour, there was some improvement in my overall decorum, though that might have been part of the problem as well. In 2005, there was a woman I had a crush on, Melissa, an artist who lived in Los Angeles. We had been sending text messages and talking on the phone for the few months since we'd met briefly in Portland. And there came to be a sort of inferred agreement that we'd hang out when Sleater Kinney played in L.A. during the Woods tour. After the concert, and as planned, Melissa and I ended up back in my hotel room, which luckily I wasn't sharing with anyone else. Perhaps I had even optimistically asked for the single. We shared rooms on tour in order to save money, but because of an odd number of band and crew, we had a single room that we kept in rotation among Corin, Janet, and myself so that we each might have some alone time. It was appropriate to request this room if, say, your significant other was visiting, or, as in my case, you were single and hoping to experience your first legitimate tour hookup. But here was the problem. Melissa and I had never really spent time together in person, and we were both shy. So instead of getting back to the room and throwing her on the bed, or her throwing me on the bed, or us mutually throwing ourselves onto the bed, we talked. We talked about our families, our work, our friends, our childhoods. As I grew more tired, I kept thinking, how much more information about former pets' names and parents' college experiences might need to be discussed before we touch tongues? Apparently, a lot more. At 4 a.m., I put on my pajamas and sat on the bed. By now, it seemed obvious that Melissa and I were going to embark on something less like the film 9½ Weeks and more like a sleepover I'd had at age 9½. When at last we had shared every detail of our existence short of our social security numbers, we stopped talking. We were lying down at this point, facing each other, our bodies almost touching but not quite. Then it happened. I'm not certain if it was intentional or if we merely bumped into each other's faces as we fell asleep, but as the morning light crept in through the cracks in the curtains, our lips touched. An hour later, the alarm went off. Those are my tour hookup stories. Suffice it to say, being single while in a band is not the recipe for opportunity that one might think. Rather, it is often a recipe for loneliness. But having a relationship is not easy either. Being on the road, recording, doing press tours, so much of a musician's life involves distraction and distance. It requires a total recalibration of what constitutes home and stability. Finding a partner who understands the vicissitudes of travel is challenging. A nomadic life fosters inconsistencies and contradictions within you, a vacillation between loneliness and needing desperately to be left alone. To someone who misses you and whom you miss, bridging that space between togetherness and apartness, literally and figuratively, can be brutal. Here's one way not to go about attempting to diminish the distance. Obsessively call your girlfriend, who is 11 years older than you, crying and telling her you hate being on tour. Rack up more than $1,000 in pre-cell phone calling card fees on various payphones because you are hopelessly in love, willing to ditch everything for this person, and paranoid that she will go back to dating men while you are away. Get so worried that you walk into a family-run restaurant, perhaps the only restaurant in the town of Lokev, Sylvania, population around 1,000, ask to borrow their cordless phone and call your girlfriend some more, sticking them with an international long-distance bill. Write lugubrious handwritten love letters that compare thee to a summer's day. Drive your bandmates crazy by quoting your older girlfriend all the time and only reading books or listening to music that she has recommended. Now your bandmates are practically begging you to dump her. But guess what? She dumps you. Of course she does. This girlfriend, who also plays music, but who is not as successful as you in this field, you think she wants to hear how sad you are to have an album that is blowing up? She doesn't. Months later, you are still angry and confused, and for the first time, very, very heartbroken. You freak out and drive to her house one morning and place a bag containing every letter she ever wrote you on her doorstep. Then you write songs for what will become the hot rock, songs about a love that is so airless it's suffocating, songs about wanting to steal your heart back from someone you feel never deserved it. And thus begins a cycle of falling in love and then getting hurt or hurting someone else by falling out of love with them, about trying to maintain closeness despite geographical disparities, then finding inspiration from all the ways you feel splintered and separate, hurt and broken. So this is one version, and not a pretty one, of being young and in a band and trying to be in a relationship. This is the version in which being gone and busy eats at you because you are scared of being left, even though you are the one who is technically always leaving. Skip ahead a few years, and there is a new version of trying to have a relationship while being a touring musician. This time, the person is the best thing you've ever had. This woman is your age. She is smart and talented and kind, and all your friends love her. You joke that they love her more than they love you. You think this might still be true to this day. Your methodology of making it work with this one is togetherness. She joins you on tour. She travels the world alongside you. You feel like a team. You swim with her in the fjords of Norway. You lie beside each other on the sand in Miami Beach. You walk the streets of Mexico City, taking countless pictures of each other and of the sights. There is a brightness to it all. And yet there is also a glare, an irritation, causing you to blink and squint. When do you ever get to be alone? To think, to read, to reflect, to not have to be on, to do nothing, to just be. This version turns out not to be working either. There is not enough separation between you and her. She needs her own version of a life to be her own protagonist. You move with her to California. She has a fellowship at Stanford. While living in the Bay Area, you write songs for the woods, songs about America, freedom, longing, depression, suicide. You start to shut down and off. You both move back to the Northwest, but you feel doomed. It is one of your hardest breakups, a real tearing away, throwing away of comfort. The Woods is out, and though you don't know it yet, it's going to be your last album for a long while, for over a decade. So you don't get to write songs about this person. There are no more melodies to write. Without putting it to music, you have to figure out why you couldn't make this one work. Chapter 13, The Hot Rock. The recording of The Hot Rock was an enervating experience. It sucked us dry. We had decided to work with producer Roger Moutinho, who recorded Yola Tango's I Can Hear the Heart Beating as One, an album all three of us admired. Our other albums had been recorded in a matter of days, but we scheduled 3.5 weeks at a vast recording company in Seattle. In some ways, those first three albums felt like purges. We'd just go into the studio and bang out the songs. It was all about capturing a feeling, a crude, aural bloodletting. But Moutinho was a producer. He labored over amp sounds and mic placement, and the songs were strange. Whereas Dig Me Out had a singular voice, the songs on The Hot Rock had two competing narratives, like a conscious and subconscious battling it out. Each song told two stories. The guitars each played a lead. All that was coherent and blunt about Dig Me Out atomized on The Hot Rock. It's a labyrinthine record, sad, fractious, not a victory lap, but speaking to uncertainty. The opening line of the first song, a song without a real title, Start Together was a working title, referring to the fact that we literally started together, as opposed to, I don't know what, staggering in at different times, was, if you want, everything's changing. And it felt like it was. Whereas the band all stayed together when we'd recorded Dig Me Out, this time around, Korn and Janet lived in separate rooms at an unassuming and generic extended stay hotel. Meanwhile, I made myself a temporary resident at the Crown Hill home of Ben and Kathy Goldfarb and their three children. I was friends with Kathy's sister, who had made the recommendation. Yet again, the band was dealing with a limited budget, and I was still young enough that the idea of crashing for free at someone's house for nearly a month felt acceptable. While I grew closer to my hosts, taking their kids to plays and the zoo and eating breakfast with them before they left for school, talking with Ben and Kathy late into the night, trying yet again to create a sense of family and belonging, I rarely saw Janet or Corin outside of the studio. We arrived at Avast each day with a sense of trepidation, not knowing the prevailing mood or what anyone was thinking or feeling. A great source of the fissure and insecurity was that Roger thought Corin was the star of the band, and certainly I would never deny Corin's importance or that her voice was part of what defined or made this band, but we'd always been a trio. He was delicate with her, careful. Janet and I often felt like the backing players. Nonetheless, Mutina loved my guitar work, and he procured some of my favorite sounds, clean and distinct. He was definitely given the most challenging of our material. Only a handful of those songs had a singularity. Most of them sound schizophrenic, but he found a way to make the disjointedness sound pretty, or at least listenable. In the end, the hot rock succeeded in assuaging our worst fear, which was that we tried to replicate Dig Me Out, but ultimately fail. Instinctively, we knew that to avoid this trap and skirt comparisons to our last record, we had to create something completely different and unexpected. The critics couldn't fall back on, well, this sounds like Dig Me Out except for, because it didn't sound like it at all. Though I knew we'd assembled a different beast, I remember leaving the studio with little sense of what we had done. We asked Miranda July to film a video for the song Get Up, the closest thing we had to a single, though by mainstream standards, it sounded like something from a distant planet. On a brutally cold morning, the ground stubborn and unyielding from frost and freeze, we gathered outside Olympia at the farm of Vern Rumsey from the band Unwound. Despite having wanted to make a record decidedly different from its predecessors, it wasn't until the 20 or so young women who had gathered to be in the video first heard Get Up blasted through the stereo that I realized achieving that goal might be jarring to our listeners. Gone, at least for the moment, was the unrelenting throttle. In its place was weirdness and wonder. It was no less intense, but its melodic interstices, its winding and dual storytelling, allowed the listener to find places to sit within the songs. If Dig Me Out had been a punch, the hot rock was the reach of a desperate hand. We hoped people would latch on. The video is as strange and avant-garde as anything we've ever done. Miranda's vision and sensibility were perfect for interpreting the song and the band at the time. A group of girls hold hands and walk through a field, picking Janet and Corin and me up from where we lie in the tall grass. There are flashes of light, of meteors. Corin's lyrics vacillate between the metaphysical and the primal. The video expresses an interior landscape of hope, promise, and mystery. Any major label at the time would have rejected it immediately. It was more art gallery than MTV. It was the first video we would show the world. Barely a week into the Hot Rock tour, I was enjoying a rare moment of downtime at Amoeba Music on Haight Street in San Francisco, digging through a bin of records, when I reached toward the middle of the stack and was struck by a feeling of electricity in the middle of my spine. I remember thinking, this couldn't possibly be good. As we continued on to L.A. and then started heading east along the bottom of the country, it got to the point where I flinched every time the van ran over a pothole or a bump. The relative smoothness and steadiness of the highway offered a reprieve, but when we entered a city, I would wince and cry every time we rounded a corner. I felt like a fragile eggshell in the back seat, frustrated that I had to be coddled. There is little room for vulnerability on tour. It's very much about survival. And one person's weakness is annoying, a burden for everyone else. All the energy and attention felt diverted toward me, focusing on my back, how I was holding up. It wasn't a position I wanted to be in, nor to put anyone else in. By the time we reached New Orleans, I was in horrible pain. My upper spine felt brittle, like it might just split in two. Every brick we drove over as we passed through the French Quarter sent a jolt of pain through my body. Backstage at the Howlin' Wolf, I hung from the door jamb. I was doing this because a club employee had recommended it, to elongate my spine as much as possible. Everyone I met was suddenly a back expert. Do this, don't do that, take this, don't take that, knot yourself into a pretzel, reach up like you're trying to pet a cloud, squat, bend, lie down, sit. The discussion and input became as agonizing as the pain itself. We had never played in New Orleans, except years before at a house party. This was our first proper show in a city we were all eager to perform in. But three songs into the show, I couldn't play another note. My guitar felt burdensome and crushing. I turned around to Janet. I was crying. That was it. We walked off stage. Our plan was to rent a Lincoln Town Car, ostensibly more comfortable than our van, with a couch-like back seat I could lie on to convalesce, and drive to Athens, Georgia, where our next show was. The van and our crew went ahead. I felt callow and infantile being chauffeured by my bandmates. We drove the 8 hours to Athens, where Corin read aloud to me while I bathed at the hotel. Generous as our act was, this wasn't tour. This was charity. The following morning, I went to a walk-in emergency clinic. Within minutes of examining me, the doctor told me I had torn ligaments in my upper spine, and that if I didn't stop playing and touring, I would only further injure myself. I was relieved, but I also felt like a kid who was about to get in trouble. I had to tell everyone what the doctor said. Our booking agent had to cancel the rest of the shows. Janet and Corin suddenly had an expanse of time ahead of them, unstructured and unplanned, with no financial gain. I had let everyone down. We'd have to reschedule. The next day I was on a flight home. I spent the following 3 weeks on my back, lying on my hardwood floors watching movies, seeing the action from that low-down, sideways perspective. I would go from the floor to a bathtub filled with Epsom salts and back to the floor. I would ice, then apply moist heat, then lie, motionless. Friends brought me food. My cat Hector perched on me like furniture. It was unglamorous and anticlimactic. It wasn't Patti Smith breaking her neck because she fell from the stage. It was me rummaging for records and snapping like a twig. It was the first time that my body rebelled against the touring lifestyle, though it certainly would not be the last. I'm sure it was an amalgamation of stress and perhaps the change from my lighter Gibson SG to a much weightier, hollow-body Rickenbacker. But that shouldn't really matter. I felt ridiculous. And the injury changed the momentum and started a precedent of me always having a problem on tour. Touring for me just meant another visit to an emergency room. I've been to doctors and hospitals all over the world. Berlin, Leicester, Denver, Seattle. This, by the way, is not a brag. Chapter 14. Help. There are many good reasons to get a manager, such as having someone to help you negotiate with record labels or do damage control when a recalcitrant band member bails, but we thought most didn't apply to us. We weren't irresponsible or uncommunicative. We genuinely liked one another and therefore didn't need a middleman to rescue us from the terrible task of having to talk to one another. And we weren't drug addicts or alcoholics. Those are the artists or bands who can't survive without a manager and whose manager acts as pseudo-parent or even babysitter. We had started out doing everything on our own, from booking tours to sending out our records to be reviewed. And though we eventually had a label and booking agent, we were successful without having to employ a larger, potentially cumbersome team. Eventually, it became more difficult to imagine integrating someone into our infrastructure whom we'd all like and respect. Plus, it seemed inconceivable to give someone money for a job we were capable of doing. But there are also much less dire reasons to have a manager. Reasons that may have been useful to us, but that we willfully ignored, or were just too stubborn or parsimonious to try. At a certain point, you have your label and the 5 to 10 people at the label with whom you work. You have your foreign labels and their personnel. You have your publishing company, your PR firm, a booking agent, a lawyer, an accountant. The manager is a very useful point person, someone to act as a veritable funnel, an organizer and translator of information, making it easier to make well-informed and stress-free or less stressful decisions. Slater-Kinney never allowed ourselves that luxury. We divvied up tasks among ourselves, from taxes to travel arrangements. We were three very capable people who liked the various business roles, so taking on this added responsibility for the most part didn't feel like a burden. But there were also times when we needed help, and it would have been advantageous to have someone uniformly on our side. Three is a volatile number for a creative endeavor and partnership. It's always uneven. It requires equality in order to achieve steadiness. When there is synchronicity and harmony, it's electric, a condensed energy, impenetrable. But more often than not, it's two against one, an incessant ganging up, with the dominance and alliances constantly shifting. I talked with Corin about Janet, Janet and I talked about Corin, and Corin and Janet talked about me. As unified as we were on stage, or mostly during recordings, we had disparate opinions about success and compromise, varying values and goals. A fourth, outside person might have been the voice of reason, someone to tip the scales in a more defined direction, to provide the clarity we couldn't always see from our cylindrical world. Corin, Janet, and I had formed such a stubbornly insular unit of a band that there were very few music business people we trusted, and even fewer whom all three of us agreed on. Only two people made it through the tough exterior and our collective agreement. Julie Butterfield was one of the first people I met in Olympia, where she had moved from Minneapolis. If you weren't in a band in Olympia, you were running a label, and Julie had a small imprint called Skinny Girl that had put out a 7-inch single or two. Julie brought a refreshing and unprecedented sense of expertise and professionalism to Olympia. She had a big city sensibility. When someone from Minneapolis has a big city sensibility, you know how small Olympia is. In 1995, when Corin and I had finished recording Call the Doctor, we wanted to send it out to press people. So I contacted Julie, who gave me a printout with names and addresses and told me which writers might be amenable to our music. She was savvy and seemed in possession of information we couldn't possibly have had access to otherwise, not without a fully staffed label or manager, not in a town that was essentially in a media blackout and that considered doing press almost an act of selling out. Julie became our publicist for nearly the entirety of our career. She was a good sounding board and always had our best interests in mind. She understood the context from which we came, not only our ambitions, but where we weren't willing to compromise. She was a friend and support system, an ally. Bob Lawton showed up when Call the Doctor and our self-booked tour started to earn us wider recognition. He was the booking agent for Sonic Youth and Yola Tango, both bands we looked up to.
Bob was a real old-school New Yorker. He'd seen a lot, lived hard, and had the accent, stories, and sardonicism to prove it.
We were an unlikely pairing. He wasn't from our world. He didn't know the preciousness or politics of Olympia or the Pacific Northwest, and he didn't really care. This meant he unequivocally fought for us, and he didn't feel limited by the unstated but very ossified and encoded rules of the punk or indie scene. That doesn't mean he wasn't ethical. He was. But he was driven, and he instilled in us a sense of worthiness. He loved our music, and he wanted people to hear it. Bob was very opinionated, tenacious with the bookers at clubs, and he knew far more than we did. Before him, we would feel blindsided by events or next steps, whereas Bob could look at the coming album and the year ahead and assess exactly what needed to happen. As a booking agent, he was pretty typical at the time, very full service, very philosophical. He wanted us to play smaller or medium-sized venues and sell them out, to make sure there was a sense of urgency surrounding the show, a sense of discovery and exclusivity, so that next time we could play a bigger venue because everyone at the first show would tell their friends what they had seen. Bob had a deep connection to our band, and he was protective of us. Over time, he developed an almost avuncular affection for each of us individually, and we admired him and trusted him immensely. He booked us right up until he retired, just before the woods. Left largely on your own, you often turn on one another. Tour was taking its toll. I found it difficult to maintain friendships and relationships in the age of the postcard and the payphone. I spent much of my time trying to tether myself back to home, but often when I got home, I found I had less to return to. Every gas station stop was an excuse to dial out from a grimy payphone, just to hear a few minutes of a familiar voice, or at least their outgoing voicemail message to get you through the next 3 hours in the van. Returning home at the end of tour, I would enter an airless house that had collected an eerie dust from misuse. Everything was exactly how I had left it, yet I felt like a stranger. That feeling of alienation was alleviated when I adopted two cats from the Olympia Animal Shelter. I named them Hector and Lyle. They provided an excuse to have someone stay at the house while I was gone, so when I came home there was evidence of the house having been lived in, comfort in the daily rituals I imagined took place while I was gone. Someone had marked time. Most of all, there were two little creatures to greet me. After a European tour where harsh words were exchanged and a plate of food was thrown, followed by a channel ride during which Corin did not speak to me or Janet, we decided we might need to bring in some extra help. Enter Susan and Nina, a couple of therapists who were couples therapists and also happened to be a couple. They tag-teamed their way through therapy sessions. Needless to say, they were in Olympia and recommended to us by a handful of friends who were also seeing them. Susan was the taller, more formidable of the two, short, dark hair, deep voice. Nina had short blonde hair, bright eyes. They were sort of like good cop, bad cop. Susan was the tough love counselor. Nina was the empath. They used their own relationship for examples, and as a result, details of their personal histories are permanently lodged in my brain. I'm not sure how useful it is to know that Nina was once married to a professional football player. Together, band and therapists, we became a 10-legged lover working through our issues. The first thing we did was make a pie chart. We were each asked to illustrate how much of our life we wanted Slater-Kinney to occupy, so we could understand how each of us might be approaching the band and its importance in our lives differently. As I looked down at my divided circle, it was the first clue I had that the band was something that represented a fair bit of anxiety for me as compared to Janet and Corin. My drawing indicated that Slater-Kinney, and in particular touring, were something I wanted as part of the story, but perhaps not the entire story. In total, we attended two or three sessions, learning to speak in I feel statements, airing our grievances, crying, and learning a lot about Susan and Nina. We left with a set of rules that served us well. No evil-minded buddying up. No breaking up the band on tour. Always say you're sorry. And if someone calls an emergency meeting, you have to oblige. Therapy gave us tools and pulled us back together, but ultimately, it was still just the three of us. Therapy wouldn't diminish the number of times we'd get angry with one another, but now we at least knew we had to apologize. Of course, now that we'd aired our deepest fears and vulnerabilities, we also knew the quickest ways to hurt one another. Chapter 15. All Hands on the Bad One. The Hot Rock had been a difficult album to record and to take on tour. The songs were tortuous and challenging to play live, each instrument traveling down a different road. As a result, we felt disjointed. The writing for our next record began between legs of the Hot Rock tour. We split the work between Janet's basement in Portland and mine in Olympia. These songs came out easy and rapid, like fast-drying glue putting us back together. We were in a hurry to return to something cohesive. Corin had been playing in a side project called Cadillaca, a retro-sounding garage rock trio with fake names and fake hair. She had come to enjoy the freedom of singing in character, male and female, and wanted to bring some of that vocal multidimensionality and nuance into our songs. Songs like Ballad of a Lady Man and Milkshake and Honey were sung with a saucy detachment that I hadn't heard from her before. Musicians, especially those who are women, are often dogged by the assumption that they are singing from a personal perspective. Perhaps it is a carelessness on the audience's part, or an entrenched cultural assumption that the female experience can merely encompass the known, the domestic, the ordinary. When a woman sings a non-personal narrative, listeners and watchers must acknowledge that she's not performing as herself, and if she's not performing as herself, then it's not her who is wooing us, loving us. We don't get to have her because we don't know exactly who she is. An audience doesn't want female distance. They want female openness and accessibility, familiarity that validates femaleness. Persona for a man is equated with power. Persona for a woman makes her less of a woman, more distant and unknowable, and thus threatening. When men sing personal songs, they seem sensitive and evolved. When women sing personal songs, they are inviting and vulnerable, or worse, catty and tiresome. Whether Corn was singing from her own perspective or someone else's, I never had to ask if she was okay. Her voice was torrential, a force, as much as it was human. The songs that comprised All Hands on the Bad One were full of proclamations and affirmations. Once again, we were in conversation first and foremost with ourselves and with each other. All Hands was a reset button. We returned to working with John Goodmanson. We sang about the experience of playing music as if it were brand new. There is a sense of rejuvenation on the album. But for the first time, we were also reacting to specific events and politics instead of doling out a diffuse rage, a la call the doctor and dig me out, or the dark yearning of the hot rock. After years spent trying to distance ourselves from what felt like overly simplistic riot girl and feminist signifiers, attempting to eschew categories that seemed only to diminish or ghettoize the band and the music, sometimes the effort of pushing ourselves away felt like an act of self-amputation, self-effacement. It was also exhausting to continually try to separate who we were from what we made, and each time I wanted things to be transcendent, to disregard gender dynamics or sexism, those things reared their ugly heads. It's hard to divorce yourself from that conversation. Especially at Woodstock 1999, when there was a reported rape and multiple allegations of sexual assault, and when "Show Me Your Tits" could have been the fest's unofficial slogan. We responded to the latter with a tour t-shirt that said, "Show Me Your Riffs," one that Korn and many of the fans wore around the release of the album. This was our workplace, a concert, the music industry. Or later, while engaging in the camaraderie of a music festival in England called the Bowley Weekender, when we found a note calling us "lady men" affixed to the bulletin board on our chalet. Or attempting to talk about our music and the process of writing an album in an interview, then to read the article and see that the writer focused on what we were wearing or how we looked, discussed our gender, or made a sexist comment in the story. This was the same time as the Spice Girls and girl power. We knew there was a version of feminism that was being dumbed down and marketed, sloganized, and diminished. We wanted to draw deeper, more divisive lines. We wanted to separate ourselves from anything benign or pretty. One of my favorite songs that Korn has ever written, "Was It a Lie?" sounds so prescient now in the age of social media and the voracious news and gossip cycles. The song is about a woman whose videotaped death is replayed for the amusement of others. Do you have a camera for a face? Was she your TV show? Was she your video? A woman's pain, never private, always seen. I want to close my eyes. I want to cut the wires. I want a day not made for you to see. We were never trying to deny our femaleness. Instead, we wanted to expand the notion of what it means to be female. The notion of female should be so sprawling and complex that it becomes divorced from gender itself. We were considered a female band before we became merely a band. I was a female guitarist and Janet was a female drummer for years before we were simply considered a guitarist and a drummer. I think Slater-Kinney wanted the privilege of starting from neutral ground, not from a perceived deficit or linguistic limitation. Anything that isn't traditional for women apparently requires that we remind people what an anomaly it is, even when it becomes less and less of an anomaly. I will now take a moment to compile for you a representative sample of journalism about Slater-Kinney. Most of these articles are actually trying to be complimentary. The authors just fell into common traps and assumptions.
You can call them punk. You can call them chicks. In fact, you can call them anything. But whatever you do, just don't use that tired, worn phrase and call female trio Slater-Kinney a riot girl band. Prior to the interview, the band's publicist even suggested that we refrain from asking the inevitable women in rock questions. But after listening to Slater-Kinney's tender yet irate brand of punk, you almost can't help it. CNN, 1999.
But never does Slater-Kinney sound forced, angry, or sweet. The three words one most associates with all women rock bands, and the three words that tend to hold women's music back from the kind of raw believability that characterizes more macho rock. Metroactive, 1999.
Post-Riot Girl Slater-Kinney are a boy rock critic's wet dream. Not just because they sport that pouty Salvation Army t-shirt wearing look that drives those guys wild, but because SK's fifth album, All Hands on the Bad One, Kill Rock Stars, is the kind of complex, multifaceted work that sparks hours of tedious nerd speak. Is it a self-important jaded up yours to their indie rock peers? Is it a portrait of the young ladies as artists? Is it a song-by-song conceptual response to the Go-Go's Beauty and the Beat? The answer more than likely is yes to the third. The thematic cohesion is remarkable. But who cares? The trio blends synthesizers, whoo, and fuzzed-out boy rock almost sweetly everywhere else, clues to the lay listener that there's more going on here than just some spoiled little tomboys postponing their entrance into the workforce. So the Y chromosome bearing, cardigan and chain wallet wearing set can pop open a six pack of Mountain Dew, kick off the Chuck Taylors, and settle in for a night of fawning. Everyone else should take all hands on the bad one as evidence that Slater Kinney aren't some overrated one-trick indie artifact to be filed between Bikini Kill and Bratmobile. And proof to the boys that they're more than three hot chicks in lowrider chords. City Pages, 2000.
The four questions Rolling Stone asked us in a mini-feature.
Who were your musical heroes growing up? Were there female musicians who were particularly influential on you?
A follow-up, perhaps because Janet had answered the previous question with Joe Strummer.
How has parenting affected your songwriting, Corin? Have things changed for women musicians much during the last decade? Rolling Stone, 2002.
Fortunately, their frequent lyrical challenges to gender roles didn't devolve into rote male bashing, and both sexes jumped and bobbed with joyful abandon. It helped that the three were quick with smiles, obviously enjoying the charged room. Washington Post, 1998.
The above were written by men and women. Obviously, it's easy to internalize sexism. You get the idea. Critics were not as unified in their affection of All Hands as they had been on the previous albums, nor as effusive and laudatory as they would be about the later two. In fact, a weekly Seattle paper called The Stranger decided to publish not one review, but instead a roundtable on All Hands on the Bad One. I read the issue in an Olympia coffee shop the day before we started our tour for the album up in Seattle. And the next night on stage, I thought about the negative criticism far more than I did the sold-out crowd. It was the last time I read a review. Despite feeling vulnerable about the mixed feedback, in hindsight, I appreciate the effort of the publication to engage its audience in a thoughtful and well-informed critique regarding a creative work, an entire roundtable, a divisive album. More and more, I am glad that Slater Kinney had little universal appeal, that there were elements to our band that were essentially deal-breakers. There was no middle ground. We were either loved or hated, but at least our music elicited a reaction and fomented conversation. I think cultural criticism and long-form critique have their place and their purpose, but for a creator, it's so easy for the discussion surrounding a phenomenon to usurp the phenomenon itself. It's worse, of course, with comment sections on websites and blogs, particularly anonymous comments, or the incessant chatter and opinions on social media. Everyone gets to write a headline, and when you or the thing you do is being talked about, you get to feel like a headline, an addicting feeling for sure, but also a pernicious one. The discourse builds its own body, and it's usually a monster. Although I will confess that All Hands has shaken out to be my least favorite Slater Kinney record, I will say that there are crucial moments on it that act as the connector between the first and second half of our catalog. There are times that a work exists for the sake of getting you to the next step, as a testing ground for ideas, for recognizing parts of your process that were theretofore unnoticed or undiscovered. Most of the other songs on the album were a continued expansion and stretching in our songwriting. There is a nod to classic rock and male model, thick, sludgy riffs that hint at Light Rail Coyote on one beat and Much of the Woods, and a catchiness in the choruses of songs like the title track and Leave You Behind paid more attention to melody than we ever had in the past. All Hands on the Bad One also illustrates the differences between how Corin and I approach lyric writing. While we often wrote the music collaboratively, we worked on the words separately. Whoever had brought in the original riff or song, or whoever came up with the vocal melody, was usually the one who figured out a theme, a subject matter. We responded to our environment in different ways. My narratives were often oblique, hers direct. She was bold. I described boldness. I read books about the Civil War and likened two obstinate people to the ironclad ships, the Monitor and the Merrimack. The Swimmer was inspired by an interview with long-distance swimmer Lynn Cox and the way she described the ocean as being a world in which she felt the most herself, needing to escape in order to be found. Corin, on the other hand, took out her anger and alarm head-on. Number One must have dealt explicitly with the Woodstock 1999 violence. Contemptuous, sarcastic, using clever turns of phrase, she was able to shove back the listener with her voice. The song also explored the commodification and co-opting of the once radical tenets of Riot Girl and punk rock feminism by the mainstream, their remnants echoed in hollowed out and sellable phrases, divorced from any form of social justice or action. You're No Rock and Roll Fun was about a certain kind of arrogant, self-serious indie boy. It was sassy and direct, with a Shangri-La-style taunting, a ganging up after having felt ganged up on. It was retaliation you could sing along to. I admired Korn for the way she wrestled our songs down to the ground with her vocal delivery, tamed them or took flight, could play with the tension between the guitar and vocal melody, could be as punchy and deliberate as the drums. She was masterful. Up until All Hands, when I sang, I often felt like the songs were on the verge of swallowing me. I didn't feel like that on guitar. My guitar could fight back in a way I never could with my voice. But All Hands was the first album where I start to sing above the surface of the song. All Hands was certainly more accessible than its predecessor. These were songs that allowed us to focus on the task of performing. They were imbued with drama. The choruses sounded like choruses. We expanded the scaffolding, and it made us a better live band. We had been operating from a place of sonic misanthropy in some ways, but All Hands also has frivolity and irony, a sense of humor despite all its seriousness and direct assessment of specifically tragic incidents. It brought the band back to the center, but scraped enough from the outer edges of what we'd reached for to give us musical fodder and confidence for what would come next. Live, we were tighter and more confident than ever, and the All Hands tour was energetic and mercifully free of injury. By the time we went to Europe during the All Hands touring cycle, I had no illusions about tour as a vacation proxy. Climbing into the van in Amsterdam, my body knew what to do when it hit the seat. Slump, readjust and sit up straight, slump again. Tour consisted of riding in the van for 8 to 10 hours a day, depending on the distance between cities. A bottle of water and a bag of chips held between my knees, a book in my hands, nodding off to sleep, then jerking awake, my body compressed and folded. Our first show of the tour took place at the aptly named Dour Festival in Belgium. I didn't recognize any of the other bands who were playing, which meant one of two things. One, the rest of the bands were from Europe. Or two, they were bands from the United States who were only popular in Belgium. It was a show during which death from electrocution felt both certain and imminent. The rain was coming at us horizontally, and much of the stage was wet, including our instruments. My guitar glistened with droplets like in a bad 80s hair metal video. It was so cold that I was dressed in layers, piling onto my body nearly everything I had packed in my suitcase. As a precautionary measure, the stage manager covered the monitors with large garbage bags, and in retrospect, I should have asked him to throw some plastic over me as well. We played to 10 beer-drinking, poncho-wearing men and a lone, poncho-wearing woman. We arrived in Paris to play 2 shows, safely indoors, opening for Sonic Youth. A bit timid after the humiliation of the previous day, we started our set the first night feeling beat down, like we had to fight our way back. It took about half the set for my confidence to return, for the music to move through me without getting tripped up on the interlopers of doubt and nerves, to know the sound belonged within me. My friends James and Ian from the Washington, D.C. band The Makeup showed up with a small entourage of Parisians. They invited us to a party. I tried to convince Corin and Janet to join, but they weren't up for a late night. In the end, it was only our sound guy Juan and I who ventured out. We arrived at a high-ceilinged apartment sparsely decorated, save for 2 large wall mirrors and neon artwork atop the mantle. There were a handful of men milling around, drinking wine and smoking. There were only 2 other women present, who I assumed to be friends of the hosts, but who I was told were actually call girls. As music played on the stereo speakers and dancing ensued, the atmosphere turned Dionysian. I sat on a sofa watching bodies become more entangled, turning from angles and lines to squiggles and waves. I mentally riffled through the files of my Olympia experiences to find the right protocol for this situation, a futile exercise. Then I thought of the Left Bank in the early 1900s about expats, Gertrude Stein, Pablo Picasso, Juna Barnes, Colette. But this was a situation where knowledge was no match for experience. I wanted to come across as insouciant. I was in a rock band. I was on tour. I was at a sexy soiree in Paris. But I couldn't even figure out what to do with my face. I held my expression perfectly still trying to appear neither overly curious nor mildly shocked. I soon realized the tension in my jaw was forming a grimace. In the end, all I could manage was the kind of shoulder dance moms do when they make shrimp scampi in the kitchen while drinking white wine and listening to Bruce Hornsby. I shimmied right out of the room, exited the apartment, and took a taxi back to the hotel. The next day, Janet Korn and I went to the designer Mark Jacobs' apartment to help Kim Gordon out with a Sonic Youth video for the song Nevermind, What Was It Anyway? We were assigned roles as ambivalent party guests and told to sit around on various couches looking disinterested. We stared past the other guests or looked out the window until the boredom would become too great and one of us would stand up and leave the room, only to be replaced by another vacant-eyed partygoer. We shot for a few hours, the action easy to execute, but the finesse and coolness hard to pull off without looking like I was trying too hard. It didn't help that I was wearing a too tight, pale blue sweater that I purchased at a French department store the day before and a pair of office employee slacks. As if to cement my sense of humility, I stepped in dog shit right as we exited Mark's apartment. I spent the walk back to our hotel in search of puddles or serrated edges with which I could rid myself of my shameful, putrid secret. Later in the tour, the band taped an Italian MTV interview in Verona under the famous balcony where Juliet stood gazing down at her beloved Romeo. Afterward, the three of us paid money to climb up that very balcony and gaze down at hundreds of non-Romeos, aka tourists. Not to say that we were anyone's idea of Juliet's either, especially after a few weeks in the van. I opened the guest book that sits at the top of the stairs. Instead of declarations of love worthy of Shakespeare himself, or at least worthy of posterity, I was met with drawings like the requisite cock and balls, an epistolary outburst perhaps best saved for bathroom stall confessionals. All of these experiences summed up the disparities and vacillations that typify tour, the ridiculous and the sublime, the charming and the execrable. In a journal entry I wrote on the flight home, I noted that it felt like I had been gone for months instead of 3 weeks. It's as if I'm wearing new skin, or rather that I hardly fit inside my old anymore. I feel stretched and distorted. The end of tour, it's almost like waking up in the hospital after an accident. Slowly you take stock of the damage, a cut, a scrape. Maybe you discover a part that no longer functions properly. Chapter 16. One Beat. In 2000, Korn called to tell me that we would need to take time off from the band. She was pregnant. I went into a momentary state of panic. What would I do without Slater Kinney? But also, who was I without this band? The quest to answer that second question led to a manic state of traveling, working, and filling up my days, weeks, and months. I made plans, and then I made more plans. I became a full-fledged research assistant to my former sociolinguistics professor and mentor. I flew to Los Angeles to meet with my uncle's ex-wife, who was an executive at Paramount Studios. I thought perhaps I could be a production assistant and get into film and television work. I applied to be a substitute teacher in the Olympia School District, which apparently suffered a shortage of qualified applicants. So, with a bachelor's degree, 5 albums on my resume, and years of touring experience, I was hired. I woke up at 5 a.m. 2 or 3 days a week, drove to a middle school or high school in town, and followed the teacher's instructions for their sub, me, which usually involved pressing play on AV equipment in science, English, and history classrooms, and showing the students a movie or handing out pop quizzes. Within a few weeks, I knew the drill. Walk into class and write Mrs. B on the board, because the kids were used to everyone being married and having pronounceable names, and wear a pair of high heels, because otherwise most everyone thought I was a new student. When I wasn't teaching, I acted in one of Miranda July's experimental short films, which involved me sprawled out on a bed in a turtleneck while a long-haired cat preened around on a floral bedspread, and I auditioned for and got a role in a local independent movie about group therapy that essentially put a handful of women who were acting and in character through excruciating group therapy while they filmed us. None of these activities told me specifically who I was or who I would be outside of Slater Kinney, but they did speak to a newfound confidence and intrepidness that I had not previously realized I had. This respite from the band also highlighted a restlessness that I found was hard to satiate. I quickly grew weary of stillness. Olympia had been a valuable incubator, but by the time I was in my late 20s, it felt decidedly claustrophobic. I had outgrown its perennial adolescence. The cyclical nature of a college town means a new crop of fresh-faced, eager hopefuls pour into and populate the city, at the same time that an older, more seasoned group, with new ambitions and new sights in the crosshairs, moves away. At a certain point, I felt too old to hang with the new recruits, too ambivalent toward the quirkiness that small-town DIY life engenders, too young to settle down, too irked by the self-aware preciousness of it all. Art communities and music scenes want to pretend like they don't care, but they will also tell you louder and more frequently than anyone that they don't care. These self-aware scenes are as cool as a secret handshake and a sly, shared gesture of recognition, but at some point I was done living inside the town equivalent of a wink. A major turning point for me and my feelings about ambition and career came during the planning of Ladyfest, a festival that took place in Olympia in August 2000. As its website declared, Ladyfest was a nonprofit, community-based event designed by and for women to showcase, celebrate, and encourage the artistic, organizational, and political work and talents of women. As a volunteer for the festival and part of a team of people attempting to raise funds, I attended planning meetings. Frustration was high, as a group of about 20 of us attempted to navigate and cater to everyone's needs and wishes, differences, and ideologies. We were often at an impasse, inert from politeness or passive aggressiveness, no one wanting to take charge or declare themselves a leader. Despite our best intentions, we had the momentum and direction of a silk scarf being juggled by a mime. During one of these meetings, we talked about press for the festival. The team that was in charge of PR expressed open agitation and disdain that many of the media outlets were most interested in interviewing Slater Kinney. At the time, we were one of the biggest acts playing the festival, and certainly the most well-known active band associated with Olympia. Here I was in a group of women, allies, I thought, colleagues, and I felt like I was being shamed for the relatively modest success I had achieved. But instead of sticking up for myself, I apologized. I downplayed my level of enthusiasm for my own work and accomplishments. I expressed remorse for the fact that my band was considered separate from the community as a whole. And truth be told, I did feel terrible, at least in that moment. I left the meeting with a pit in my stomach. Later, however, I was livid and heartbroken. I felt like I had been thrown under the bus and betrayed by my own gender. As much as I love and loved Olympia and owe so much of my musical upbringing to its ethos, it was a place I needed to leave. I never wanted to feel ashamed for striving, for desiring, for ambition, and I never wanted to judge another woman, or anyone for that matter, for their own aspirations, even if they differed from my own. When Corin's son was born, I began traveling to Portland more frequently, so that we could write songs and I could hang out with her new baby, a boy named Marshall. I spent many hours on the couch catching up with Corin. I held Marshall in my lap, placing my lips on his downy, delightful infant head. I was downtrodden, bewildered, and ungrounded. I wanted to be closer to this feeling of home, of love. Portland seemed my only viable option if I wanted to keep the band intact and vibrant, and I did. In the fall of 2001, with 9/11 like a new sky over the country, a different air on our skin, changing the way we saw and felt everything, I decided to leave Olympia altogether. I moved to an apartment in southeast Portland that October with my cats Hector and Lyle, fresh from being cheated on and a subsequent breakup, and in that post-9/11 mindset where all the structures you felt like you could count on now seemed tenuous. You acknowledged the unsteadiness and either braced yourself against it or let it transplant you somewhere else. I didn't go far. My new home was 2 hours south of my old one and only 5 miles from the border of the state I'd lived in my entire life. Compared to Olympia, Portland seemed both cultured and urban. It felt like a real city because of how derelict it was, how many homeless people, how much garbage and grit. A city's scope could be measured then not by the number of good restaurants, coffee shops, and dog daycares, but by the quantity of problems it had. Its realness could be quantified by its deficits.